Joining us on the phone right now is Professor Shmuel Lissick. He is the Assistant Professor of Psychology at the University of Minnesota, and he joined us over the phone from down in Minneapolis. Professor Lissick, thank you so much for taking time to be with us on the Roadhouse.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I think everybody probably knows, unless they've been sleeping or something for about a year or better, we're approaching the date, December 21st, when, according to some people, the world is going to end. They attribute this to a Mayan calendar, and although there's a fair amount of discussion about it, and even what I thought was just probably nonsensical, it appears that some people are taking it pretty seriously, including the National Aeronautic Space Administration that even has on their website telling people, no, this really isn't going to happen.
Right.
Is this an example of what, now you deal with fear, you're a lot of what you do centers around people's fears. Is this an example of irrational fear, Professor, or not?
Well, that is a good question, and the rationality of fear has everything to do with the outcome. So if, in fact, the world is destroyed this month, it's a very rational fear. But if not, then it's not a rational fear. So, for example, a U.S. soldier in Iraq, let's say, fearing roadside objects is a very rational fear. But if they come home and they're driving in their neighborhood and they find themselves panicked when they pass roadside garbage, you know, that's where it becomes pathological. But something like this, it's hard to know. I mean, the thing is that the threats are not very credible. And in fact, people who are even providing information leading people to think there might be an apocalypse, like Lawrence Joseph, are not saying it very confidently. Like, you know, Lawrence Joseph, he found that peak activity and solar flares seem to be occurring with the end of the Mayan calendar. And I think Lawrence Joseph was saying is, this is an interesting coincidence. Maybe there's going to be something big that will happen. And quote unquote, he says he thinks there's a non-negligible possibility that this coincidence of events will mean something big for our planet. He's calling it a non-negligible possibility. And my point with that is that we as human beings, and even lower mammals, are very susceptible to false alarms.
Mm.
Now, I believe this is a false alarm. Lawrence Joseph, who is one of the people who's the source of it, has said it's a non-negligible possibility. But we're hardwired to take even uncredible threats seriously, because in our evolutionary past, there was a greater response cost to missing a real threat versus having a false alarm. So it's sort of better safe than sorry.
Sure.
And evolutionarily, that served our species well. So what I think is going on is that you have a few individual actors like Lawrence Joseph, who may be intellectuals of sorts, who may be conspiracy theorists, who may be people with a misanthropic disposition who are looking to scare people, and they're making these rather irresponsible claims about apocalypse, but people are susceptible to it because we're hardwired to be susceptible to it. And I could talk a little bit about what might be happening in the brain to make us susceptible to false alarms as well.
Yeah, and I want to get to that in just a minute. We're visiting with Professor Shmuel Lissick, Assistant Professor of Psychology at the University of Minnesota, talking about fear. I think it would seem to me that other things that would add to it are when things like the French government closes off a pass going up into the Pyrenees for fear that it will get clogged with people trying to escape, they simply add to it. But I want to go back to that irrational fear just for a second, and I thought you drew a great distinction with the soldier. I guess my question would be, as well as outcome, isn't isn't it also possible that whether a fear is irrational or not is has to do with the person? Because what I'm thinking about is if you tell a little, if a little kid is afraid that there's a monster in the closet, and you might, as an adult, say, "Well, that's just an irrational fear." To the kid, it's not irrational at all. Or is that is it more outcome that has to do with whether fears are irrational or not?
Well, that is a good point. You know, I think that you know, there is better and worse information about looming threats, and certainly as adults, we should have some ability to discriminate between believable and unbelievable threats based on our experience.
Sure,
is what we know about the world. Does it give credit? Does it give credence to these ideas? And as adults, we're pretty. Kids are not so good, but adults are pretty good at discriminating reality-based from unreality-based. But at the end of the day, what really matters is the outcome.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if the ultimate threat is in fact potent and imminent, then the fear of it was rational. And if not, then it's not. Because we do find ourselves in the human condition as having an imperfect knowledge about the world. We feel vulnerable. And we do need to work on imperfect knowledge, and we learn from experience. So if something bad did happen on December 21st, which I don't at all think it will, we would then learn from that in fact, the Mayan calendar does have much predictive power. So we would then integrate that information into our understanding of the way the world works. But given where we are right now, and given what we know about the way the world works now, there's no good reason to believe that December 21st will bring anything. We will recalibrate if December 21st does bring something bad, but we do need to depend on our best guess, our best educated understanding of the way the world works.
And there is a number of people who, in fact, a lot of people in the Mayan culture plan to celebrate that day rather than fearing it, because they believe that it simply marks another stage. I'd like to get back to what you said, point that you made, that we're hardwired. Can you talk a little bit about what happens in the brain and literally what happens in the body when we get fearful, when we get afraid?
Yeah, sure. And I hope when I talk about it to emphasize the aspects of that brain system that make us susceptible to false alarms.
Yeah.
A good example is I'm walking in a forest and I look down and see a squiggly line. And immediately I may have some fear because that squiggly line resembles a snake.
Mm-hmm.
So very quickly I may become afraid. If through further visual analysis of that squiggly line, I see that it's a stick, I then calm myself down. But the issue is that in terms of the brain, let me tell you what might be going on during this experience. I look down, and we're talking about in 10 milliseconds or so, 20 milliseconds, very quickly, that visual information transfers from my retina down the optic nerve to an area of the brain called the thalamus, which is the sensory gateway to the brain. The thalamus then has a very, what's called a quick and dirty projection to an area of the brain very important for fear and anxiety called the amygdala. And that sensory information goes from the retina to the thalamus to the amygdala in extremely fast. We're talking, you know, 30 milliseconds, and that's what's responsible for the very quick response to anything that resembles a danger. But the thalamus, this sensory gateway, also sends that visual information about the squiggly line to higher order areas of the brain for more sophisticated processing, and that's generally in the cortex. And so the visual cortex can discriminate can do more fine discriminations between visual stimuli. And if that analysis concludes that it's in fact a stick, these higher cortical areas actually inhibit activation in this fear-related amygdala-based circuit. So So that's a little bit of what happened, what's thought to happen in the brain. A lot of what I just said is based on animal research, but there's accumulating evidence that this model that has been found in animals applies to humans as well, because these areas of the brain, like the amygdala, are very deep in the brain. They're very evolutionarily old. They're mediating very primal responses.
I want to remind our listeners that we're visiting with Professor Shmuel Lissick, professor of psychology at the University of Minnesota. It's really interesting, and I want to ask you whether there is a difference. You use two words that I want to ask you if there's a difference. Is there a difference between fear and anxiety? Now, you mentioned walking through the woods and I see a squiggly line, and if I'm afraid of snakes, I could suddenly react and think, oh, there's fear there. Is that different than the anxiety that I might feel over, well, let's use the example of the Mayan calendar, the predictions, the end of the world?
Right.
Is there a difference between those two?
Yeah, researchers would say there's a difference. It's somewhat an issue of semantics, but I think there's some agreement that fear is a response to what's called a phasic stimulus, or an event that happens in the here and now. So there's a bad thunderstorm, I'm afraid. That's fear. It's thought that the brain can't sustain that high crisis response for very long, and if the danger becomes more long-lasting, you move into anxiety, which is more of a free-floating arousal that is less acute but can be maintained over time. So, yeah, I think you're absolutely right that in 2009, when some of these ideas about the Mayan calendar and apocalypse came up, between 2009 and 2012, one cannot be fearful. You can't have that acute fear response to an imminent threat. It becomes more, you may have it upon hearing about the possibility of apocalypse in 2009, but it will turn to anxiety, and anxiety will be more of a free-floating kind of a lower level arousal.
Makes sense. And are some, you use the words again, hardwired, and I like that. Are some people better wired to deal with fear or anxiety than others? I mean, it seems to me that fear is kind of a part of life almost. But some people seem to handle it very well and others don't. But why the difference?
Right. Well, that is the million-dollar question in the clinical anxiety realm, and people are trying to figure that out. You know, one idea is that people who don't deal as well with fear have they have a more sensitive fear circuit, so less danger information is needed before they get afraid. So let's say, maybe somebody who has a low threshold for getting afraid after they've experienced 9/11, all they would need to do is even see a plane flying on TV would make them afraid of 9/11. Whereas somebody who is a more resilient to anxiety, it would require much, much more danger information. Maybe it would require them to hear about a real threat to the U.S. From a foreign actor in order to get afraid. So there are lower thresholds of fear reactivity. It's also another idea, and this is something that I study at the U, is generalization of conditioned fear. And I have data pointing to the idea that people who have anxiety disorders are more prone to generalize fear from the danger cue to stimuli that resemble the danger cue. And that leads to an increase in the number of stimuli in one's environment that can elicit fear if I'm generalizing it to things that resemble but are in fact benign. So the generalization process may be important for differentiating those who are or are not prone to anxiety disorders.
And I would think also along with that, and that makes sense. I mean, you talk about thresholds. Some people have higher or lower thresholds of pain. It would make sense that perhaps they would have the same as far as anxiety. I would also think that perhaps if a person has experienced a situation, let's take that soldier again that's in wartime and in a firefight, something that really does legitimately cause fear, that they are perhaps might be more likely to be afraid when a sound, a sight, or something like that re-triggers that. Do you think that's true?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, in the direct aftermath of a life-threatening event like being in Iraq, it's normal to have a very strong response to things that resemble that danger situation. What differentiates people who have PTSD from people who don't is that those symptoms need to last beyond a one-month period.
Oh.
And the DSM, which is the Diagnostic Statistical Manual for diagnosing things like PTSD, it's sort of an arbitrary cutoff, but it's the one applied, is that these symptoms need to last beyond 1 month of the traumatic encounter in order to qualify for post-traumatic stress disorder.
That's interesting. I'd heard the time frame put on it before.
Yeah.
We've been visiting with Professor Shmuel Lissick, Assistant Professor of Psychology at the University of Minnesota, talking about fear, both rational and irrational, and definitely real as well. And fortunately, Professor Lissick, it sounds like, at least in your learned opinion, we don't need to lie awake nights thinking, worrying about December 21st.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I think that the few people who are predicting the apocalypse are capitalizing on the human vulnerability toward false alarms. And this is what seems to be a big false alarm.
Yeah.
And we're vulnerable to false alarms, and we need to try to rationally counter that primal response to false alarms.
Well, and if in fact you're wrong, it won't make any difference anyway, will it?
That's true. But I certainly agree with you. I have no fear whatsoever that anything's going to happen December 21st, and I would like to think that everybody else will not as well, because I think it's unnecessary stress.
Yeah. Professor, I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us. It was really interesting. I wish we had more time to talk about it. But again, thank you so much for taking time to be with us.
Thank you.
Take care.